Welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm your host, Carl Morand. Today I'm talking with David Lesh, author of the new book, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Through the experience gained during his many trips to Syria and numerous meetings with Bashar al-Assad, Lesh is able to provide an explanation of how Assad has been able to stay in power through numerous crises prior to the 2011 uprising. He analyzes Assad's transition from reluctant president to self-proclaimed savior of Syria and ultimately brutal dictator. While Assad is commonly thought of as merely another Arab tyrant who is soon to fall, Lesh's unique experience interacting with various members of the Assad regime, including Bashar al-Assad and his wife, enable him to portray the Syrian president in a three-dimensional manner. His description of Assad isn't meant to excuse the atrocities he's committed, but rather to provide an understanding of the motivations behind Assad's actions. As Lesh explains in the interview, the fall of the House of Assad isn't meant to signify that the regime has, or even soon will, be toppled, but rather to illustrate that Assad has lost his mandate to govern. In the eyes of Lesh and many millions of Syrians, Bashar al-Assad has fallen from being the great hope he once was. David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. If you could you start out by telling us a little bit about your academic background and what led you to write this book?
Well, I received my bachelor's degree from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and it was there that I really got interested in the Middle East in the late 70s, early 80s, because there was a lot going on then, as there is now, with the Iranian Revolution, the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So I kind of just migrated over into Middle East studies, and then from there went to Harvard University to get advanced degrees, MA and PhD. And then fortunately, I found a very good job here at Trinity University in San Antonio in 1992, and I've been there ever since. And I have focused on, obviously, the Middle East. I'm technically a modern Middle East historian, and one of my areas of expertise, in addition to the Arab-Israeli conflict and U.S. foreign policy toward the Middle East, is Syria. And I've been to just about every country in the Middle East multiple times, but I've been to Syria the most. I've been traveling there on a regular basis for the past quarter century, probably going there over 25 times and sometimes spending a great deal of time there. And it was during those occasions and that I made some contacts and networked and eventually met a lot of people that current President Bashar al-Assad brought into the government, which opened the doors for me to request meeting him and being able to meet him on a regular basis for a number of years. And I think that's one of the main reasons why I wrote this book, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, not only to shed light on the uprising itself, the causes and consequences, the domestic, regional, and international dimensions of the conflict, but I thought, you know, what I have to offer that's unique is my knowledge of him and the Syrian leadership in general, who I also got to meet on a regular basis, to shed light on their motivations, how they see the world, why did they make the decisions they made in terms of not making the reforms that many people demanded and of course, sanctioning the brutal crackdown that's now 18 months later. So I thought that's, you know, what I could offer. Especially in the West, because we just don't have an accurate picture of how Syria and how Syrians and particularly the Syrian leadership see the world. And not that it's a correct view from Damascus by any means. It's in many occasions skewed, but it's skewed by their own history, their own heritage, and their own view of the world. And I thought that that's one of the things I could offer in the book is portraying and revealing that particular view, which I think informs their decision to crack down on the protesters.
Definitely. I think one of the best parts of the book is the portrayal of al-Assad in more of a three-dimensional light as opposed to just a sort of flat tyrant character, which we sort of see nowadays. You describe in the first chapter called The Hope, you mention sort of the hope people had for him as he took over as somewhat of a, you know, reluctant president, sort of falling into it after his brother was killed. Could you talk about what your sort of perception, what your thoughts on him were before you knew him, and what sort of changed your mind, or what made you think that he could be, you know, the hope for Syria?
Well, what interested me in the first place, and why I wanted to write an earlier book on him that was published in 2005, called The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria, also published by Yale University Press, was that he was different. He didn't have the typical profile of a Middle East dictator, so to speak. He was a licensed ophthalmologist. He was, you know, kind of the accidental president when his brother, who was generally, you know, accepted to be the one being groomed to succeed his father, was killed in a car accident in 1994. Bashar was actually in London at the time getting an advanced degree in ophthalmology, and he was brought back and slowly, you know, brought into the ruling apparatus and elevated into a position where, you know, he was able to take power when his father died in 2000. So he really had the atypical profile of a Middle East ruler, and that really was interested me quite a bit. And I was curious about learning about him, so I made the request to meet with him in 2002 through a friend of mine who was an academic that I knew years before and was now in the cabinet. In fact, the fact that Bashar brought a number of academics into positions of power in the government was one of the things that led many people to think that he was different, that perhaps, you know, he might implement a broad range of reforms and change that might incrementally change the authoritarian system in Syria. And I finally got the go-ahead to meet with him extensively in 2004, and I, of course, met with him on a regular basis until 2009. And he was always, when I met with him, certainly in the beginning, quite the normal person, relatively speaking. He seemed to be a very good family man. He was always very gracious, very unpretentious, and almost self-deprecating. And, you know, that seemed to be quite different from the typical authoritarian ruler. And he tried to implement change in areas where he could, because he really didn't gain full control, I think, of the ruling apparatus until about 2005, 2006. So when I started first meeting him in 2004, he was still searching for ways to make reforms in areas where he could, and particularly in education and in reforming some of the administrative apparatus. Some things in the economy, political reform, always lagged far behind and always would for the remainder of his time in power, it seems. So a lot of us, and not just in Syria, but in the West, because of this different profile, had had high hopes that perhaps he was a different leader than his father had been, and that he could implement change. I think, however, and I remember writing about it at the time, and much more so later on, that I think expectations in the West were too high for him. In fact, the first time I met with President Assad, I half, you know, jokingly mentioned to him that the worst thing he did was, you know, make it known in the West, or make it known that he liked Phil Collins music. And of course, in the West, it was widely disseminated, and everyone, you know, it reinforced this this profile that was emerging, that he was a pro-West modernizer who was a, you know, computer nerd, an ophthalmologist, and that he would implement change dramatically. And I remember thinking at the time and thereafter that was, you know, missing the point a little bit. He was different in many ways, but he wasn't in other ways. I mean, it wasn't the 18 months he spent in London that was the, you know, the formative period of his life. It was being the son of Hafez al-Assad. It was being a child of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the superpower Cold War and all the tumultuous events in Lebanon. Those things shaped his worldview, I think, much more so than, you know, the technological toys of the West or the music of the West. And unfortunately, I think the expectations were too high in the West, and maybe even in Syria itself. And when those expectations are that high, you're bound to disappoint. And the level of disappointment is going to be deeper. And I think that's what happened fairly early on.
You mentioned his time in London, and as you point out in the book, that lots of people sort of hoped or assumed that because he had lived in the West, and I think that's a notion that is applied to other leaders in the Middle East as well, is that they have spent time in the West, so they're going to be significantly influenced by it. Do you think his time in London had much influence on him at all? Did you notice any sort of influences or anything that he brought back from his time there?
I asked him that, and we discussed it fairly thoroughly. And I think that in terms of trying to bring Syria technologically, you know, into the 21st century, to find a niche in the international economic community, try to find some value added for Syria that would give it some sort of advantageous position in the international marketplace, as much as India had done. He had brought that up several times. So I think it had that type of effect in terms of improving the technology, the infrastructure, the economy of Syria. But I don't think the politics and the democracy and so forth in existing in England and elsewhere in the West had as much of an effect on him. I think it did to a certain degree, and I think in the beginning he tried to some political reforms in what was called the Damascus Spring soon after he came to power, but that was turned around very quickly as most of the the old guard, so to speak, that had been in power, positions of power in Syria for decades, they realized that would undermine their positions, their socioeconomic and political positions, and so there was a retraction from that brief opening. And I think Bashar realized then and there that there's only so much he could do in terms of political reform. And so he must therefore concentrate on these other types of reform that unfortunately over the years tended to accrue more to, the elite classes in Syria that tended to reinforce and expand the gap in the distribution of wealth and socioeconomic status between this elite and the rest of the country.
You mentioned that during the first few years of his presidency, he didn't have much control over the sort of the security establishment, mm-hmm. but that he eventually sort of took over and, gained their respect and gained the authority. He then had some sort of big tests during the middle of the 2000s with the Hezbollah conflict with Israel and also with the Hariri assassination. How much influence and control do you think he had over Hezbollah at the time? And do they, was he really the one sort of calling the shots there, or was that other forces?
Yeah, no, I think his father had a much more controlling relationship with Hezbollah. In fact, many people would say that the relationship went in reverse, whereas, in the 90s, Syria was the senior partner and Hezbollah the junior partner. By 2005, 2006, 2007, certainly after the Israeli Hezbollah war in the summer of 2006, that it had flipped and that Hezbollah actually was now the senior partner because of the popularity of its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, and that Syria was the junior partner. So Hezbollah had a great deal of independence in the actions it was undertaking. And if anything, Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime were riding on the coattails of his popularity after 2006 for a number of years. So they have some influence, the Syrian regime does, because, the Iranian money and training and arms tends to be funneled through Syria. So Syria, through that alone has some sort of influence. But Hezbollah, I think, is still provided Syria with a conduit of influence in Lebanon after the Syrian troops evacuated Lebanon following the Hariri assassination. So Hezbollah, in many ways, has almost been, as important, or maybe even more important to Damascus than the other way around.
You mentioned an incident in 2007 when you were traveling to Syria for a scheduled meeting with the president, and you were actually detained at the airport and interrogated for several hours. I was wondering if you could go into more detail about that, because that sounds like a very fascinating story.
Yes. Most of the times I've visited Syria when I met with the president and had a scheduled meeting with him, I would be met right off the plane, right on the tarmac, by cars from the office of the president, protocol officers, and I'd be taken to the hotel. Every now and then, that didn't happen because if there was another leader in town or the protocol office was otherwise occupied, and I'd have to go through customs like everybody else. So on this occasion, in November 2007, when I arrived with a scheduled meeting with the president, there was nobody meeting me at the airport. So I, a little disappointed, obviously, but I realized that that wasn't terribly unusual. So I went through customs, and when I went to the customs officer, he said basically I was blacklisted, and he confiscated my passport, and then I got taken to this little room by security, which is part of the Mukhabarat, the security services in Syria. There are many different branches of the security services, and airport security is one of them. And I was brought into a room. There were several officers, and there was one colonel who asked me a series of questions and doubted that I was, there to meet with the president. He was asking me why I was there and what I was up to and all of these things. And it was interesting. I was seated in a very low chair, and they were all in very high chairs. He twirled what I guess was a loaded gun in front of me, almost like Russian roulette, trying to intimidate me. And basically, I didn't get too worried about it. I kind of understood what they were trying to do, and I thought probably the worst thing is that I would just be kicked out of the country. But I finally convinced him that it would be worse for him if he did not make the call to the office of the president, which I'd been beseeching him to do, than to kick me out, because he would get in a great deal of trouble with the president's office. And so he finally made the call, and he found out that indeed I had a meeting with the president, and he immediately turned several shades of white, pale white, was very, he all of a sudden became my best friend. And one of the interesting ironies of that is he found out that I had written this book on Bashar al-Assad, and he asked me for my autograph. He didn't have a piece of paper, so he gave me the actual list of blacklisted people on which my name appeared, and so I autographed that for him. So I finally made it through, but I saw the president early the next morning. And of course, one of the first things he always asked was, how was your trip? And I said, well, other than the 3-hour, interrogation at the airport, it was just fine. And he was, aghast and appalled by all that. And he gave an order that, to somebody, he said, oh, this will never happen again. Of course, it happened again in February, a few months later. So even the president's decrees don't sometimes get followed or make it through to the security officers, although that detention was not, was nothing too severe. And I remember telling him at the, when we were discussing this situation, I told him, Mr. President, you really need to get control of these guys because it could come back to haunt you. And he said he knew that they engaged in excesses from time to time, but his position was always that it's a necessary evil in a dangerous neighborhood. And to some extent, that is true. It is a dangerous neighborhood, and there are threats internal and external. And he'd just been through a number of threats and attempts by the West to overthrow him. But in my mind, it was, a kind of abdication of power to the Mukhabarat, to the security services. And he was giving them way too much leeway, and that ultimately that could hurt him, and by them engaging in these excesses that in the right conditions could come back to unseat the regime and cause a rebellion. And in a way, that's exactly what happened, because it was the hubris of the security services in roughly handling those children in Daraa in March 2011 that lit the fire of the rebellion in Syria and allowed the Arab Spring to seep into Syria. And so, he, in my mind, he acquiesced to that level of autonomy on the part of the Mukhabarat, and he never really attempted to gain control over them. He accepted that notion that they had to maintain this type of leeway and power in order to protect the regime, instead of trying to curtail their power and change the nature of the authoritarian system.
At what point do you think Bashar al-Assad sort of made the switch from the reluctant president who's just sort of thrust into this job and sort of doing his duty for his family and for his country to really taking control and sort of, as you allude to several times in the book, sort of feeling like it's his destiny, that he's supposed to be the savior for Syria.
I think I suspect it started to happen, particularly after the Hariri assassination in 2005, and having survived, the worst the international community could do to him in the aftermath of that. He was internationally isolated. The U.S. and its allies were actively trying to overthrow him, basically, and he survived that. And then you had the Israeli Hezbollah war and riding the coattails of popularity of Hassan Nasrallah. And I think that created a sense of almost triumphalism, if not cockiness on his part, that he had taken the worst shot that anyone could take, and he survived and it was actually flourishing, in relative terms, by 2008, especially when the Bush administration was going out and the Obama administration coming in. And I think that really started to change his view of his position in Syria and in the region, and if not the world. And he started to believe the propaganda and press surrounding him and all the sycophants that on a daily basis, in one way or another, would tell him that his destiny was synonymous with Syria's, and that his well-being was synonymous with Syria's well-being, and only his staying in power would lead to a better life for Syrians in general. And if you're told that on an everyday basis, I think you start to believe it. On a personal level, I saw it become manifest on an earlier meeting, actually in 2007, in May and June of 2007, during his re-election referendum that was held at that time. And he won like 97% of the vote. Of course, he was the only one running, so to speak. And there was so much pomp and circumstance surrounding that quote-unquote re-election. He had eschewed the personality cult before that time. He actively, dissuaded people from hanging up posters and throwing parades in his honor and all this sort of thing that tended to accumulate during his father's time in power. But in 2007, I saw it all return. And rather than him, I expected him to roll his eyes saying, well, this is what happens, I'm letting the people do it. He encouraged it and he embraced it, which was surprising to me. I remember at that very moment when I was with him, just me and him, and he had almost a cathartic reaction when I asked him about all this, what I call and what I describe in the book as his Sally Field moment, when Sally Field got her second Oscar and mm-hmm. up on the podium and said to the Hollywood community, "You love me, you really love me." And I almost got that sense from Bashar that he felt this, that the people really loved him, and that he believed it all, when in fact probably 75% of everybody out there was arranged or orchestrated, or people felt they had to do it because they didn't want to be seen as not supporting the president because of the security services or watching everybody, and that's how things work. And I thought he really understood that, but he bought into it, and that's when I really thought to myself that he had drunk the Kool-Aid of power and had now assimilated into the authoritarian system rather than changing the authoritarian system. And I remember thinking at that moment, I didn't verbalize it, but I thought, well, you are now the president for life. Whereas up until that time, most times I met him, it was, he was doing his job and trying to do the best he can. And you got this sense that, this is not something that he was going to do for the rest of his life. But in 2007, I got a completely different vibe from him.
Based on that and his sort of acceptance and belief that he had become president for life, do you think if he could go back in time and, at the beginning of the Arab Spring, see what's happening in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, do you think he would do anything differently than he's done, or do you think he would follow the same course that he's chosen?
I think he'd follow the same course he's chosen. I think from the very beginning he saw this as a security solution. He was very much taken off guard and very surprised by how the Arab Spring hit Syria. He was making comments, and his spokespeople were making comments, just before it broke out in Syria. They were actually showing support for the protesters in in Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere. And he felt very secure in his position. He thought he was popular beyond condemnation. He thought that because he had opposed Israel and the United States consistently, that that would be enough to prevent the Arab Spring from coming into Syria. But he misread the situation, as many people did. He failed to really comprehend the socioeconomic rationale and reasons and causes of the uprising, and the level of political repression that over the years that people had been getting more and more tired of, and that the Arab Spring had broken the barrier of fear for many Syrians because they saw what was happening in other countries and dictatorial regimes being overthrown. So he failed to really understand all of that. But on the other hand, I think that the way he had, evolved in the position itself, the way he and his supporters see the world, they really do believe, as he said in his first speech addressing the uprising on March 30th, 2011, that the uprising is being caused by conspirators from the outside and armed gangs and who are working with pernicious and dangerous outside forces like the United States and Israel and Saudi Arabia and others. Many people thought that that was a blatant misdirection from the real socioeconomic causes of the uprising, but I contend that the Syrian leadership, and most importantly Bashar al-Assad, actually believe that more than most people would think, because of this evolution of how they see the world and how Syrians have such a paranoid view, and not just the leadership, but most Syrians in general have such a paranoid view of the outside world. And that's just developed from their own history and their own experiences, because there just have been enough, imperialist and great power machination inside Syria over the decades since it became an independent country in 1946. There's been enough of that to convince people that it happens all the time. And I think that's what, many, people in Syria, the so-called silent majority, they're loath to join the uprising, because they've enjoyed the stability and security that the Assads have provided them over the decades, fighting this type of pernicious forces from the outside again and again and again. So, I don't think he would have changed anything looking back. Some things in terms of military strategy or security strategy, but overall, I really do believe if I saw him today, he would tell me he's saving the country from itself, even, that he knows better, and that what he's doing is the right thing for the country in the long term.
Compared to many of the other leaders that are facing popular uprisings in the Middle East, he's been in power a relatively short amount of time. Do you think if the Arab Spring had happened in the beginning of his presidency, when he had only been in office a few years and was still the sort of reluctant president, that things would have been different, that he might have just used it as an opportunity to be a sort of transitional leader as opposed to president for life?
That's an interesting question. I think it could have gone one or two ways. I think he could have embraced the change and use it as a way to outmaneuver perhaps some of the old guard in Syria, because the population still was very enamored with this new young ophthalmologist who became president. And because he had yet to become the person that he became by 2006, 2007, somebody who was very comfortable with the authoritarian, someone who had become very comfortable with the authoritarian Syrian system. So perhaps, added to the momentum that was created with the Damascus Spring that lasted for 8 or 9 months to outmaneuver the forces of resistance in Syria, which are very strong. On the other hand, if another way it could have evolved, if that happened at that time, is the forces of resistance, the old guard, so to speak, might have acted and moved against Bashar, maybe put another family member in or some other Alawite general who would be more trusted and with maintaining the system as it existed and fighting against the level of change. And in that case, you know, it'd be a very similar situation to what exists right now with the government crackdown.
During the initial weeks and months of the Arab Spring, it was one of the, you know, major news stories of the year, of the decade even. But now it seems to have sort of transitioned to a point where it's only occasionally in the news when there's a major massacre or attack or, you know, violent upflare, and then it sort of drifts away and people don't think about it. Even to the point where I'm sure you're familiar with the satirical newspaper The Onion, and they had a funny headline back in July that says, "Scientists say U.S. may have discovered previously unknown level of not caring about Syria."
That's funny.
And I'm wondering, what would you say to, you know, the average American who maybe doesn't follow this closely as to why they should care about what happens in Syria?
Yeah, I agree. Unfortunately, the Syrian situation has become routinized in the American psyche and therefore in the American media. And the only time we hear something is when there's an atrocity that occurs that, you know, usually perpetrated by what are perceived to be government forces or government militias. And in a way, that kind of has reflected what has happened to Syria. It has settled into this protracted civil war where the government and the opposition really don't have the wherewithal to land a knockout punch to either side. And so, you know, you have this give and take. And unless there's something injected into the equation which will change the balance of forces, such as outside intervention, which I don't see happening, I think this protracted stalemate will continue. And frankly, I think the Syrian government probably doesn't mind. They don't want to be on the front pages. You know, they see this in a long-term sense, that they can turn this around in 10 years. And in 10 years' time, you know, they'll be able to reassert their power, be able to re-ingratiate themselves into the regional system and in the international community, because they've seen it happen before. You know, the Middle East affords countries a number of opportunities to get back into the fold, so to speak. Egypt has done it, Iraq has done it, and then gone in reverse and so forth. And so, you know, the Syrian leadership, I believe, takes this long-term view. Unfortunately, you know, what can happen, is that, the sectarian conflict and civil war can spill across the borders into Lebanon, into Iraq, could possibly, escalate into some sort of an Arab-Israeli confrontation. And then you have all sorts of problems, and this becomes just a nightmare. I think most of the international community would be very happy with insulation of this civil war, and not having it spread across the borders in any direction. However, you know, if it does, then we'll be seeing this Syrian crisis in the news again. And not in a very good way, and it will place the international community and the United States in a very difficult or more difficult position than it already has been in terms of making the decision on whether or not to intervene militarily or send forces in to separate other forces. And so that could be very dangerous and of course, something that I think most people want to avoid. I think most of the international community from the very beginning wanted the Syrian situation just to go away, just to fizzle out. They were hoping beyond hope, in retrospect, that Bashar al-Assad would make the reforms necessary that would at least split the opposition and Bashar's forces could take care of the rest. That's why they gave Bashar al-Assad a lot of rope in the beginning, and why it took several months until President Obama and the European Union finally made the decision that Bashar al-Assad had to go. Because they realized that he wasn't making that choice, that in fact he had chosen the security solution. But it, you know, Syria has become so entangled in regional and international politics that the slightest disruption to this stalemate could spread diplomatically and militarily beyond Syria's borders. And as I said earlier, then we'll be seeing it in the news every day again, and not in a good way.
You mentioned that President Obama and European leaders have said that Bashar al-Assad has to go, and many have said that it's a matter of if and or a matter of when and not if. But you say in the book that the regime has engaged in a Machiavellian calibration of bloodletting, enough to do the job, but not enough to lose what international support remained. Do you think, at this point, many leaders have said, you know, it's time for al-Assad to go, but no one seems to really want to step up and sort of flip the switch to make it happen. Do you think there's anything they could do short of, some people have said, using chemical weapons on their own people? But do you think there's really anything that could get the international community more involved in the Syrian conflict?
It would have to be something along the level of the 1982 massacre at Hama, where 15 to 25,000 people were killed at the orders of his father against a Muslim Brotherhood uprising that had basically evolved into a civil war at that time, and the Muslim Brotherhood was carrying out assassinations and killings of their own. What's ironic about that is in 18 months of the uprising, it appears that between 15 and 25,000 people have been killed, about the same number that were killed in a couple of days in Hama. And I think the regime has been very careful in trying not to have an episode like that, and of course not use chemical weapons, which I don't think they will unless they're in their last breath in power and feel that's the only way they can stay in power. But on the problem with that is that the regime has associated themselves with some of these militias, the so-called Shabiha, who are these fanatical, mostly Alawite supporters of the regime who for money, because they fear that they'll be wiped out if a Sunni Arab regime comes to power, if Assad falls. The regime has given them a lot of leeway and almost sanctioning their dirty work that gives some level of plausible deniability to government forces. Once you unleash those type of forces that carry out these atrocities, it's very hard to rein them back in. So, something could happen perpetrated by these paramilitary forces that might compel the international community to assert itself more than it already has. But I don't see anything happening, short of something like a Hama 1982 or certainly chemical weapons that would generate that type of international response, because there's just no appetite in the international community right now. The international community is too divided. The regional situation is too delicate. And we really don't understand Syria and what's going on there very well. We don't understand the opposition forces, who are fractured and divided among themselves, and we don't even know who would get the arms. And some people have equated Syria to Afghanistan in the 1980s when we armed the Mujahideen and people like Osama bin Laden, and of course it came back to haunt us because we didn't understand the nature of the forces in the opposition in Afghanistan. And similar in Syria, we don't really understand it. There's not one coherent, unified, coordinated group in Syria that really has an address that we could support, unlike the National Transition Council in Libya that the U.S. and NATO successfully supported last year in overthrowing Gaddafi. And even that had some complications. And of course, in the aftermath, there are even more complications, as we've seen in recent days. Syria is a much more complex situation. It's a much harder nut to crack. Establishing a safe haven would require establishing no-fly zones, and the Syrian anti-aircraft defense system is much more sophisticated than Libya's, and it's much more integrated in the large cities in Syria, so there'd be much more collateral damage. The Syrian army is much more capable than the Libyan army, and much more loyal to the regime, despite the defections that have occurred to date. So I really don't see anything short of a huge catastrophe in terms of a Hama 1982 style massacre or chemical weapons generating the necessary international support to take more assertive action.
I'm curious if you were talking with or advising leaders in Israel who might be worried about a large Arab state very near to them imploding almost at any given moment, How would you advise them to handle it, and how would you advise them to sort of talk to their friends in the international community to handle it? Because it seems like from the U.S., it's maybe safer or easier for us to take a sort of wait-and-see approach, but for them, it's, I imagine, a much more tense situation.
Yeah, Israel's situation is very difficult. The Arab Spring in general, not just Syria. I think they were prudent, in the beginning, and for the most part until now, in terms of not really giving opinions on the Arab Spring, because they could do more harm than good to the forces that would be more advantageous to them by inserting themselves, into the mix or giving official opinions on what is going on. And they did so with Syria. I mean, there was a debate in Israel regarding Syria in the beginning that to some extent still has gone on. But I think, the Israeli leadership has come around to basically accepting that Bashar has to go as well and will go at some point. But in the beginning, there was this debate over, better the devil you know. And despite, not agreeing with Bashar al-Assad on many things, he was a stable and knowable entity who had engaged in direct peace negotiations with Israel, brokered by the Turks in 2007, 2008, when Israel carried out some, clandestine attacks, or what most people think was Israel, in Syria. Syria didn't respond against Israeli targets or anything. It kind of accepts its asymmetrical junior status to Israel. So, many Israelis were worried that Bashar might fall and what might happen in the aftermath, that there would be this chaos and instability, possibly a radical Sunni Islamist state on its border, on its northern border. So, many people were just saying, just hang back and relax and hopefully Bashar can get through this, as much of the international community was doing as well. But I think they realized as the uprising went on, as the crackdown became more brutal, as the international community, most of it came out against Assad, the Israelis started to realize that he had to go as well. But they really can't do anything to guarantee that any, post-Assad environment will be advantageous for them or be a stable environment where they wouldn't have to worry too much. They've already, I'm sure, engaged in beefing up their defenses on their northern border in the Golan Heights against Syria. And their biggest concern right now, I think, is if the Syrian regime, in a last dying, breath and attempt to stay in power, might try to transform an internal conflict into an Arab-Israeli one and lob some missiles into Israel, as Saddam Hussein attempted to do in the 1990-91 Gulf crisis and war, to transform what was then a different crisis into an Arab-Israeli conflict. So I think what they're hoping for is whatever happens, that Syria just doesn't break down and implode and chaos occur, where there could be forces that get their hands on chemical and biological weapons, where there's any sort of radical Sunni Islamist regime committed to destruction of Israel, or a regime which could likely happen as well that comes into power after Assad that is no less a friend of Hezbollah and Iran than Assad is. That's not a guarantee that just because Assad falls, that the regime that comes in is going to break ties with Tehran or with Hezbollah. So there's so many variables out there and I'm sure the Israelis are planning all sorts of different contingencies for different contingencies. And essentially, if I was advising them, and I think what they're doing is just, wait and see. Some elements in Israel late in the past week or so have come out and tried to encourage the U.S. to intervene more directly on behalf of the Syrian opposition. But I don't think that's the official government view. It's just some of the more right of center elements in Syria and in Israel are advocating that. But that may go hand in hand with the same groups in Israel that are advocating the U.S. take a more aggressive stance vis-a-vis Iran. So Israel's in a very, for them, difficult position where they have to be fairly passive and wait and see rather than taking action.
if Al-Assad is able to maintain power and endure a civil war that the rest of the world seems unwilling to intervene in, what effect do you think that will have on the U.S. and Western nations' ability to influence foreign policy in years and decades to come, given the many statements that it's time for him to go, you know, Bashar al-Assad's days are numbered?
Yeah, I think if Assad somehow survives, and which is plausible, I don't think he will ever have the level of control that he had during his first 10 years in power. I think, you know, he's lost his mandate to rule. He's lost his legitimacy, and certainly, you know, the level of popularity he had in the country. And at most, you know, I think the government may control, you know, a certain percentage of the country, whereas there are other areas that are outside of his control or have virtual autonomy, such as the Kurdish area in Syria and in northeastern Syria. So I think from the international community's perspective, who never had much influence on Syrian policy, I think what they can best hope for is that Syria is, you know, basically is insulated, that the breakup of Syria into these fiefdoms or warlordism, you know, doesn't become something like a new Lebanon or an Iraq after 2003, that could spill across borders. Already, Turkey's fairly, you know, tense about you know, this autonomy that the regime has given the Kurds already in the northeast, and how the deteriorating relations between Syria and Turkey have compelled the Syrian regime to support the PKK again, this Kurdish group that fighting for independence and autonomy in Turkey. And in essence, what's left of Syria in terms of, you know, the territory under government control would, in many ways, in my view, if the Assad regime survives, become something like the North Korea of the Middle East, where it's this isolated and diplomatically isolated country that's shunned by most of the international community, and they become, you know, a hardened shell of what they had been, and the ruling regime will stay in power, and the people will be even perhaps controlled even more, at least those that are in those territories that are under its control. So it's not a very pretty picture, and this is why I, you know, ultimately what might have to happen for Syria, for the Syrian people in general, is for one side, you know, particularly the opposition side, to win at some point, particularly if it's more of a Syrian solution to this. And this may take a long time. But usually in these cases, somebody, some faction, hopefully will emerge in a level of popularity and authority that cuts across all of the ethnic and religious sectarian nature of Syria. Can maybe bring the country back together again. But, you know, I really do think this will take at least a generation to play itself out.
Given your knowledge of Syria and your contacts there, do you see anyone who could potentially, any person or group that could be a sort of a front runner for the group to emerge as a potential leader in a post al-Assad Syria, especially given the sectarian nature? And you mentioned in the book al-Assad's ability to sort of, even though he comes from a minority community within Syria, his ability to use different minorities and sort of play them against each other and use the sort of fear factor to maintain his power. Do you see anyone that could legitimately sort of take over post al-Assad?
Not really, unfortunately. The opposition is so divided amongst themselves. They've been fractured in many different ways. There's many different fault lines in the opposition, between the more Islamist groups and the more secular ones, between the those opposition groups that are on the outside and those that are fighting and dying on the inside. And that's a huge gulf. That's a huge fault line that will be very difficult to overcome. And then those that want perhaps a more negotiated solution, and the increasing majority that want a more militaristic solution to this. And then there are personal antagonisms. There are antagonisms that were exploited and developed by the regime over the decades. So that's why there really hasn't been any generally accepted group that has been able to unify all these different groups together against the regime. Even the United States has kind of moved away from the Syrian National Council, which had generally been the group that most of the international community accepted as the interlocutor for the Syrian opposition. There are a few individuals, such as Michel Kilo, Riyad Saif, Riyad Turk, who had opposed the Assads for years and were, you know, in and out of prison over the years, and they had been part of parliament as well. So they are respected senior statesmen, who could perhaps bridge some of these gulfs and these fissures between all these different opposition groups. But on the other hand, it's become so militarized in the opposition, as well as in the government, it's become such an existential conflict that many of these individuals who gained such respect and who have been calling for a negotiated solution maybe have been discredited and delegitimized because it has become so militarized on each side.
I'm curious, in the book, you mentioned that in the summer and autumn of 2011, many headlines in major newspapers were predicting the imminent fall of Assad, but that by the end of 2011, they'd sort of flipped, and it seemed as though he was going to stay in power, and they were focusing on the ways he was maintaining control. I'm wondering, at what point did you feel that, okay, I can, you know, title this book, The Fall of the House of Assad, that this is where things will most likely be going?
Well, when I came up with the title of the book, I was fully aware and expected that the regime would stay in power past the publication date, maybe long past the publication date, because I understand and know the resiliency of the regime and maybe more importantly, their determination to stay in power. But I named it that way for two reasons in particular. One, in a more personal way, that Bashar al-Assad, to me personally, had fallen. He went, you know, he developed into a type of leader that was particularly distasteful. He developed into the typical Middle East dictator who would do anything to stay in power, so to speak, for whatever reason and however they saw the world. So to me personally, he had fallen from that person in whom many people had high hopes, including myself, into someone who would sanction this brutal crackdown. So he had fallen in that sense, and the House of Assad had fallen. In another level, again, the mandate to rule for the Assads, father and son, was to provide security and stability in a dangerous world, and maybe even some prosperity from time to time. It was a Faustian bargain with the Syrian people that they would provide this security and stability in return for their subservience and giving up certain freedoms. And most of the Syrian people bought into that. But that's gone. You know, obviously, the Assad regime has not provided the security and stability. In fact, their policies in sanctioning the crackdown has brought about the instability and chaos that we see today. So they've lost that mandate to rule. They've lost that legitimacy to rule. And so the House of Assad, in that sense, has fallen. They've failed that mandate to rule. And therefore, they will never have the level of power and authority and legitimacy that they once enjoyed.
Is there anything that has happened after you had to submit your final manuscript for the book that you wish you could have put in or that might have changed your analysis of things?
No, not really. I wish I could have covered some of the defections, particularly Manaf Talas, who I know quite well, who is a Syrian general from one of the most famous families and maybe the family most responsible for bringing the Assads into power. But you know, the book had just gone to press. The manuscript had just gone to press like the day he defected, and I wrote a piece in Foreign Policy on that. And again, to really counter what the international community and the Syrian opposition were saying, because the international community and opposition were saying this is the beginning of the end, you know, yet again saying that It's the beginning of the end for the Assad regime. The edifice is cracking and so forth and so on. And what I wrote in that article and what I would have written in the book is that, Manaf Talas had been marginalized within the inner circle for a number of years, and that he was Sunni. He wasn't part of the Alawite inner circle that also includes some Sunnis as well. While a spectacular defection on the surface, it really didn't hurt the functioning of the inner circle of the regime, therefore, this was not the beginning of the end, and the edifice of the regime actually was quite strong. And same with some other high profile defections, although it creates this. It creates this image that perhaps it's cracking, which in itself, can be devastating to the regime. On a real level, the regime was staying together and hanging together because they all feel they're in the same boat and they'll sink or swim together, much more cohesively than that which we observed in places like Egypt and Tunisia and Libya.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember the Talas defection, and it seemed like, that was yet another event where, okay, it might be, the house of cards is about to fall, and then a few days later it seems to sort of fade away.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's interesting is that ever since probably October, ever since Gaddafi was found and killed in Libya, I've been asked on a consistent basis by some of the major media outlets in this country and in Europe for comments on what they were working on in terms of an obituary for Bashar al-Assad. They were, they want to get one ready just, in case when he falls so they can publish it, and they want to get comments from Syrian analysts and so forth. And each one of them, I said, this is really premature. He's going to stay in power probably for much longer. I gave a few comments anyway, but obviously, the many predictions that he was going to fall imminently were wrong.
Well, I guess they were just hoping that you could see into the future and accurately predict his death.
Right. Well, I guess if you name a book The Fall of the House of Assad, they think I'm going to agree with them.
Well, David, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today. If you could, before I let you go, could you briefly tell us what you're working on now, what upcoming projects you have?
Well, I have a book that I edited along with my colleague Mark Haas that's called The Arab Spring, Change and Resistance in the Middle East, being published by Westview Press, and that's coming out in November. And Mark and I are very pleased with that book, and it's getting some very, very good initial reviews. And I think it gives a very readable assessment and examination of the Arab Spring throughout the Middle East, not only in the Arab countries who experienced the uprisings, but also the regional context and the international context, between the United States and Russia, Turkey and Iran and Israel and so forth. So I think it really gives a complete understanding of the Arab Spring, as we know it up till the writing. So I think it's still, even though there's a gap of between the finishing of the book and the publication date, I think it still holds up very, very well. And then I'm also working on a book on the modern history of Syria, which is kind of a magnum opus, so to speak, of all the things I've written on Syria over the years, and that will look at the modern history of Syria from the late Ottoman period in the 19th century through the uprising, and maybe by the time it comes out, the end of the uprising.
Excellent. Well, I'd love to talk to you again when that comes out.
Sure, it'd be my pleasure.
Well, thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today.
Okay, thank you, Carl.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. And thanks again to David Lesh for taking the time to talk with me today about his new book, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. You can follow New Books in Middle Eastern Studies on Twitter, where we are at New Books Mideast, as well as on Facebook. To send me your comments or to suggest an author or book for a future show, you can use the contact information on our website, newbooksinmiddleeasternstudies.com, where you can also find links to subscribe to our show. Also, if you enjoy the shows, please consider taking a moment to rate and review them on iTunes, which will help more people find our shows. Thank you for listening.